Don't turn it off now. You need this stuff. Tampa Bay's Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who loves a good book. Coming to you from Tantalk Studios here in beautiful Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to read. Well, I'm so happy today we have in the studio Bill Larson, our own legal eagle, who's going to be telling us about some of the I think he's got an interesting legal case that he's found, and then one of you listeners out there, it was so nice of you, Abigail, to send me this story. I had not seen it, and it's about Frederick Colting, who is back. I think I mentioned him once before because he's the one who was sued about borrowing J.D. Salinger's characters and continuing on with his own story. And so he was sued once before, and he's being sued again. So, hi, Bill. Let's talk about this.
Yes. Very interesting case.
Okay. Well, this guy,
Frederick.
Frederick
from
here.
Sweden.
Yes, from Sweden. He doesn't want to give up. I know he's a nice Swedish boy, and I really would like to talk to him. But I don't think I can have him on the program because he's going to... I would get sued, maybe, because this guy cannot stop himself. I mean, really, the guy can't stop himself.
It started several years ago when he adapted the Salinger's book, The Catcher in the Rye, and he basically turned it into a children's book.
Okay.
Nice idea, right? Get kids interested.
I don't think J.D. likes that.
Yes, he's turning in his grave. So he got sued. Uh-huh. And apparently there was some kind of settlement, but it's unclear to me from the research I did exactly what the nature of the settlement was. They're arguing now back and forth the terms of that settlement. Uh-huh. Well, in any event, Frederick has now gone and created several more children's books based on adaptions from some very great books from Ernest Hemingway, Arthur Clarke, Truman Capote, and he calls them the Kinder Guides.
Ah.
Right. So, and he admits that he takes the underlying work, the classic novel, and then he adapts it for the purposes of children, which is, nice.
It's nice, and he adds really nice illustrations so that it's really, really creative.
It is very creative.
Really, it is very nice.
There's only one small problem.
Uh-huh.
And that is the folks that wrote the original works, or they're the estates that have now inherited those rights in copyright, feel that it's an infringement and that Frederick is not entitled to make these adaptions for these children's books. And Frederick has a very interesting defense. He's trying to make the defense that this is for the purposes of education. So I think where he's angling is kind of what we call fair use defense.
Well, like Cliff Notes. Cliff Notes takes books. That's what he mentioned, I think, in his thing.
He mentioned Cliff Notes. That's an example.
Look, Cliff Notes, they've got in there, and I actually hate Cliff Notes, but they've got in Cliff Notes, they've got all the characters, they've got all the, they do a beautiful synopsis of the story, they tell you everything.
For students who don't want to study.
That's it, and that's why I'm against them. I really am against Cliff Notes, but okay, so at least he does it with really pretty pictures.
He does. He does a great job, so it's a great adaptation. But unfortunately for Frederick, the copyright laws prohibit that.
Yeah.
All right? Because the author has the right to determine whether derivatives can be made. Okay? And that's what he's doing. He's deriving. He's adapting the work. And you can't do it without permission. And I don't know if he tried to get permission and they said no, but he's going forward anyway. And it looks like there's going to be another lawsuit. And so we'll keep an eye on the case. But I really like his defense. I'm not sold on his defense. I don't think he's going to prevail on it. Maybe there'll be a financial arrangement somewhere in the works to settle the case, but based on money. But the problem that you have in copyright law is that there's a gray area, right? It's not just black and white. And a lot of laws are like this. There's no open and shut case. So he's probably got some pretty fancy lawyers there from New York City, and they're going to put up a good defense.
I think that the estates of Truman Capote, Ernest Hemingway, Arthur C. Clarke, of course, the writer of 2001, The Space Odyssey, and Jack Kerouac, I think they have pretty good lawyers, too.
They do. So it's going to be a bunch of great lawyers, all of whom probably have an interest or an agenda in the law. based on their clientele, right, and their folks that they represent. So it's there for a reason, okay? And so they want to try to set the law, obviously, if the one side of the attorneys can convince the jury to say, well, we think this is okay, then they've got something for their clients.
Okay, well, I think on this, Frederick's going to lose, because I know that Ernest Hemingway and Truman Capote, those families are not going to let this stand.
No.
So
no.
I would suggest, perhaps, if they're still for sale, maybe we should all buy them and they'll become collector's items, because once they're done, they're done.
Right. Once the cow's out of the barn, you can't take it back anymore.
So maybe in a few years, you'll be able to sell it on eBay for lots of money. That does happen. I'm trying to think. There is a very famous book that was recalled, and it went on eBay. There were only a few, you know, versions out there, and it was recalled, and I think there were like 10 copies of it out. And
it's almost impossible these days now that you can digitize things so easily.
Yeah.
So those days are kind of
boring. But still, hard copies are always more collectible. So, you know, you never know.
You know, so this begs the issue in authorships and copyright laws. Where's the line drawn?
Yeah, that's hard.
And it's such a hard question to answer. And I'm sure a lot of the authors who are listening are asking themselves, well, you know, I've read these books by other authors and I like their style, or I like their format,
uh-huh,
or I just like them. And I want to do something that's not the same, but I maybe use a little of the genre or the backdrop. And where is the line?
Exactly.
And the line is not clear.
Yes.
And it could not be any more less clear than in this case I found between best-selling author Sherilyn Kenyon versus Cassandra Clare. And as we were discussing, they write paranormal books and use very...
With a little romance.
With a little romance, right? And use very typical themes. And so it's interesting because in this particular case, I found the complaint and I found an attachment to the complaint, which I'm going to show you here,
okay,
which shows the argument of the similarities.
Ah.
Okay, so the characters in here, basically it's the Dark Hunters versus the Shadow Hunters. So right off the bat, right, we've got some similarities, dark versus shadow.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the Dark Hunters argue that... we have a character that believes himself a normal human until the night when a mysterious Dark Hunter saves his life. And that's basically the same theme in the Accused book in The Shadow Hunter. He has a supernatural power bound and doesn't know about them until after his mother is kidnapped by demons. Same thing in the competing novel. Okay, so you don't have a word-for-word plagiarism, right, which is your bright line test for
That would be
copyright infringement. That would be easy. You really just have these themes that if you went out and read a whole bunch of other books, you could probably find them here and there, sparsed around, okay? Maybe not all in one single work, but the argument could be made, well, I took a little here and I took a little there and put it all together, and that's all you did, and you can't just take all these common themes, put them in a book, and then shut everybody else out. That's the argument, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's a very interesting case. This is another one where there's going to be a lot of gray area. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about copyright law is that in order to infringe a copyright, you have to have access to the work. You have to actually copy it. So, for example, if the writer that wrote Shadow Hunters had never read Dark Hunters, and this is all a coincidence, even if it was identical, it's not copyright infringement.
Ah.
Okay. There has to be actual copying. In other words, the person accused of infringement had to have had access and read the underlying work and then made the adaption from there. If it's a coincidence, even if it's identical, it's not an infringement.
And in this case, were they able to prove?
Well, the defendant in this case saying, I never read your book.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And how do you prove that?
Now, check her Amazon account.
Right, check it, right? So you can have some evidence maybe there.
Yeah.
But how do you find out if she got a hold of that book and read it in a room and shut the door? How could anybody ever know? So copyright law realizes that, okay? Copyright law realizes there's not a fly on the wall that's going to come and tell us, no, she definitely did it, she read it, she had access to it. The defendant will always claim, I never had access to it, I never seen your work before, it's a coincidence, okay? So the courts have come up with a way to determine the infringement if you can't prove access by substantial similarities. And what is substantial similarities? It's anybody's guess. Right, that's for the jury to decide. Right, and that's why we have these gray areas in these cases, and that's why they're just fantastic cases cerebrally, and then also in terms of the celebrities that can be involved.
Oh, I would like to get on a case like that. They probably not allow me to be. It was so funny. Last Tuesday, I wasn't here. I was actually in the courthouse, and I had been called for jury duty. Mm-hmm. My first time in my life that I was called for jury duty.
Excellent.
And, I mean, I would have loved a case like this. And then I wouldn't have tried. I didn't try to get out of it because I said, you know, if necessary, I could just have you here for the whole hour and you could take over the show if I wasn't able to make it here on Thursday. Although the judge had said, well, case should be over on Wednesday, but I can't guarantee it. But
were you picked?
It was so funny. I had never experienced. You don't see this in books, and you don't really get the idea of what it's like to be on one of these jury pools. Now, it's a beautiful courtroom that we have here.
It's lovely.
Unbelievable. I was so amazed. It's state of the art.
System here.
Absolutely beautiful. And it was really a lovely place to be, and the staff are incredible. Mm-hmm. They are all so nice.
All the jurors say that.
Just amazing. I mean, if you're going to be a criminal and you have to go to court, I suppose it's nice to go to a nice one. And if you're a juror, it was really nice the way they treated us. And I had never, you know, been in a panel, and there were 40 people. But it gave me so many ideas as I'm sitting there listening to the, you know, they ask these questions of the jurors. I had no idea that they did all
this. You can't
create
stuff better than what happens in the for real.
I mean, this was fantastic. I mean, I really should now write a courtroom drama. As a matter of fact, because there starts off with a panel of 40 and they're, you know, winnowing it down, and people come up, you know, one guy came with a baby and, you know, the guy was not impressed, you know, get rid of it, I'll do something. You know, it was so funny down in the, when they were selecting the jurors, but they all had so many interesting stories.
Mm-hmm. And but how did you feel about the questions you were asked, what we call voir dire?
Yeah, I thought it was really great. I loved it. And I mean, the stories, I heard stories there that I never even imagined. And it was so funny. And then at one point, because it kept dragging on, I was thinking, you could easily write a murder mystery right here in this court. In this courtroom.
Just on that case.
Because the jurors, some of the jurors were ready to kill some of the other jurors because they were like talking so long and giving their whole life story about everybody. When they're asked a question, is anyone in your family ever been involved in the legal system? And then we'd get some of these jurors would go on forever. And it was like everybody in their family from their great-grandfather had been arrested for something or the other. And some of these people waiting because they were hoping for a day and a half trial, you know, like, oh, okay, we'll get in. Let's start it already. We're ready. Oh, they were getting really. So I thought, oh, that'd be fun. Maybe, it's a great place, actually. Now, they don't let people in to watch it, you know, watch the voir dire.
Yeah, the jury selection.
Yeah, but for trials,
you
can just go in there, right?
Open to the public.
It's open to the public. That's right. You know, that's a fantastic.
One of the greatest things about our system.
I think I had never thought about doing it because wherever I lived, the courtrooms looked creepy and horrible. But this, I could sit in there all day. They're very comfortable.
And they've done that on purpose.
Yeah.
And so if you have nothing to do someday and you want to go down and see something interesting, you go down to the courthouse and sit.
I tell you, you're going to get
stories. In the gallery
and
watch. Oh, it's great stuff. Great stuff. And not just the criminal stuff. You've got the child custody. You have civil lawsuits fighting over money. You have a lot of great stuff. Well, great place for ideas.
For any writer who's stuck and looking for an idea, go down to this courthouse. And there, everybody is so nice. And the bailiffs are amazing people. Just
we have a fantastic system.
I mean, it's fantastic. The judge said this entire building was paid for with this penny for Pinellas. Mm-hmm. So if that's where it went, they did a good job because
sounds like you had a great experience.
I wouldn't have. I didn't want to be on that particular case. It wouldn't have been something I was interested in. But I would have really liked.
I think you would have been a good juror. because you're attentive.
Oh yeah.
You're fair.
Yeah.
Open-minded.
That's it. That's what you have to be.
That's all a lawyer wants.
Now, I don't know if they'd let me on a case like this one. plagiarism.
Yeah.
Plagiarism.
I'm
on there,
weed it out on
yeah,
a case like
there,
this.
There, they'd say, okay, she's read
she knows too much.
She knows too much,
right.
And you know, and that is a problem, because there was a instance in this jury selection that what this man was accused of was something that another man knew everything about. You know, and so he wasn't, of course,
struck.
Like, it was just, he was too knowledgeable about the whole thing. I don't think either side wanted him, so, you know, but
that's
it wasn't.
Where the prejudice comes in,
yeah.
Sometimes, even if it's not intentional, which
yeah.
They may have underlying things.
Yeah.
And that's why we have this process to kind of get those facts out so we can understand where a juror is coming from, because even subconsciously, they could be persuaded or prejudiced by their own life and their
yeah.
own events that they've experienced.
Yeah.
And really what we want as attorneys is somebody who doesn't really have a lot of experience with whatever we're litigating, but is fair and open-minded and will follow the law. And the biggest problem we have is no one wants to follow the law.
No.
That's the problem. The jurors just say, all right, let's... I mean, they're just going to go off on a tangent and decide themselves. That's one of the issues that we
now,
have.
In this kind of a trial, this case that you're talking about, this would be a trial where there'd be six people, a juror?
Six or 12, depending on the particular venue, probably 12. And it will be a jury. And
uh-huh.
Unless both parties waive their right to a jury, then they can take it right to the judge. And this is kind of the case I would think that the defendant would want a jury, because they feel that they can have a better persuasion with a jury than a judge. Certain cases you want a judge, but this will be decided by a jury, and it will not be an easy one.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing for jurors to have to, you know, if they're going to do this comparison. Will they have to read the book and...
Oh,
both
yeah.
Books?
Yeah.
They'll
yeah.
have to read both books? And
they won't have to, because they are limited to reviewing the evidence that the lawyers put into the case. So if the lawyers don't put the book into the case, but as a matter of law, you have to put the book into the case because it is the evidence. Whether they have time to read it, I don't know. Maybe they will, and they can make up their own mind. But it'll be a very interesting case, and maybe a tough one for the defendant, because from the plaintiff's standpoint, they have...
Where's this case taking...
It's in Manhattan.
Manhattan.
Yeah, in the district court in Manhattan.
It's just
one of the fabulous courts in the planet.
Oh, yeah.
One of the greatest courts that's ever existed, federal court there. Just everybody up there is very smart. And so it'll be a case to watch. It'll be very interesting, and there's all kinds of, you know, juicy facts in the case and the type of writing and the paranormal and the...
Yeah, it's
very
interesting. So, well, one of the, you know, one of my guests was Mary Higgins Clark, and she was saying to me that one of the things she did when she first started writing mysteries was she did attend courts, you know, all the time. She would go into sit in the court and learn and listen
lessons,
and
right.
then and make friends with the lawyers.
And if you're going to write those types of books, you have to, because you want to be accurate in terms of the words you use, like you said, bailiff or dyer.
Yeah.
You know, all these.
Yeah.
Legal words that you need to make it real.
Yeah.
It's a whole new vocabulary.
Exactly. And well, that I think that's one of the reasons Mary Higgins Clark is always so successful, because mm-hmm. her books, you really feel like you're in the courtroom when they're...
And I've heard of authors yeah. that spend enormous amounts of time doing research into history and so forth to understand the backdrop of where they're going to put their theme.
Okay. Well, I'm almost ready to get up there and go up to New York and sit in court. But that's an interesting case. And will you follow it along?
Yeah, we'll follow it along and see
where it takes us.
Heads. Yeah, it hasn't been pending that long, so I doubt it's settled yet. So we'll keep an eye on it and see if it makes it into trial. And then we can see what the arguments are for and against
yeah.
infringement.
And then
there's a lot to lose, remember, because there's a lot of money at stake. These are both best-selling authors with
yeah.
tremendous followings. They're both beloved by
their fans, their readers.
And so there's a lot to lose here. Credibility, not to mention financially. Also, the copyright laws can be kind of stiff because the plaintiff, if they prevail, get all their attorney's fees, which will be in the millions.
Oh, wow.
Right. They're probably doing it. You know, on a basis where they have a contingent
now,
aspect to it.
This comes to the idea of when an author signs a contract with a publisher, don't they have to, is it part of the contract, doesn't it say that it's not based on anything, that it's an original work?
They do. Everybody would say.
Everybody.
Yeah,
so,
right, that'd be a requirement.
So
almost a warranty.
Yeah, so if, I would say if
so you don't blame the publisher,
yeah.
right? You don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah.
The publisher... Unless you can show that there was some kind of fraud and the publisher
yeah.
did that on purpose, that would be very rare. It's the author themselves. But you would think the publishers can look at these works and say, this reminds me of something else.
But if they haven't read it.
But if they haven't read it. So
they can't do
so
it.
So it's not so much the publisher, I think. It's just between these two authors who are vying for largely the same crowd, okay? The same market share of individuals that like this type of authorship. Okay, and even though they may be a little divided between one or the other, and apparently these are still like Harry Potter fans, those types of folks that like these kind of books, you're vying for the market share, right? And there's a lot of money involved.
Okay, well, this is going to be an interesting case to follow, and we'll also follow this Frederick from Sweden. Frederick. Okay, Frederick, you have to get
convince
some new
us.
Ideas.
You have to convince us.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to work, Frederick. Start writing. You know, there's so many.
Well, it's interesting because he completely admits that he copied it.
Yeah.
That's not his defense.
And I can see the interest. I mean, I would love to see a sort of a kid's version of Old Man and the Sea. And unfortunately, Ernest Hemingway's not here to write it. And if his estate wants to do it, they'll hire somebody if the estate
wants to, they can give permission, give them a license, and then they can share the money.
Exactly. And one of the things now in Hollywood, I understand that actors now are renegotiating all their contracts to cover the idea of them being re-digitized after they're dead.
Yes.
You know, it's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm sure now somebody will come out with a computer program and say, okay, this computer program can write just like Ernest Hemingway. Then what happens?
Right.
Huh? What's going to happen when somebody does that?
Yeah, if it's a computer that does it.
Well, yeah, what would happen?
I don't know.
Seriously, this is an idea.
No. The other crazy case of copyright was where somebody handed a camera to a baboon and took a picture, took like a selfie, really famous selfie. It was a pretty good shot. It was a pretty good photographer, this monkey. And then they tried to claim that the monkey had a copyright interest in the photograph so that it couldn't be exploited. And the court said, no, monkeys don't have rights and copyrights.
They don't?
No.
Are you sure?
You have to be a human.
Well,
so, but I don't know how that'll play over the computers.
I don't know. I don't know. I have a lady whose dog she considers he's human. So
yeah. Oh, you see elephants that paint in Thailand, all kinds of stuff. Dolphins. Yeah. Stuff.
What happened with that elephant who painted the picture? Did it belong to him?
I forgot. I think that that's the same ruling, is that an animal can't achieve a copyright, so it's instantly public domain.
Okay.
I think that's where it panned out.
Okay,
so
well.
So cookie cases.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Pleasure.
This is fantastic. And next time you're here, we're going to talk about fan fiction.
Fan fiction.
Because
let's do
this
it.
Is a big deal. I've had some writers here who have, done some great fan fiction.
We'll have some great information for listeners.
We'll have a lot of information. It is the up-and-coming thing with Wattpad and... I'll have all of the other information about the fan fiction. And
what you can do and what you can't do.
Exactly. And
or shouldn't do.
Bill Larson. Bill, tell us your telephone number where everyone can call in. And I know that you offer free consultations.
Absolutely. Here in beautiful Largo, Florida, 727-546-0660. Larson Patent Law.
Okay.
Please call us.
Okay. So if you have any questions for Bill, just give him a call and he'll answer them. And it would be just wonderful for you to meet him, and he can go over it. He'll even explain how to file for a copyright. So let's say bye to Bill for now, and I've got another guest coming up. I think he's calling in from London. So we'll be right back, okay? Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side, on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Lawrence O'Brien. Hi.
Hi. How are you, Patsy?
Oh, great. Do you like to be called Lawrence or Larry?
Larry's fine.
Okay, Larry. Well, where are you?
I'm in Dublin, Ireland. I'm sitting here in our office right in the center of Dublin, and it's cold outside. Where are you?
Oh, I'm in Florida, and it's hot. It's going to be 82 degrees here today.
Oh, you lucky thing.
Yes. I think you have your radio on. You have to turn it down.
We got a little reverb.
But anyway, we'll work. I think we're working through it. Okay, good. Okay, well, Dublin, that's fantastic. Oh, well, you know, I don't know where to start with you because you are an amazing writer. And I don't know how I missed you. Because when you came to my attention, well, you very nicely contacted me, and I don't know how I missed you. But when I start, well, you have now put a new meaning into puzzle mania, because all of your books are the puzzle something. And when I read, was the Istanbul puzzle the first one, right?
That's right. Yeah, the first one.
That was the first. And I don't want anyone to actually, I'm not going to tell anyone about the beginning of the book, because I was so amazed. And I hate when they do on Amazon, they tell you what happens in the beginning. I don't like that. I mean, because I'm reading it and in the first few pages, I don't know what's going to happen. And wow. It reminded me, your writing reminds me of Nelson DeMille. I know you've been compared to Dan Brown, but I love Nelson DeMille. That's, you know, that's just how I saw it the minute I started reading. And then after that, I said, not only that, Alfred Hitchcock would just love this book.
Oh, thank you. I have always loved adventure stories, and I've always loved something that keeps moving fast, something that has a little bit of romance, but something that has good, strong male character and keeps moving fast. Good, strong female character is really important as well, of course. But something that keeps moving, that keeps the pages turning, and that has exotic locations and mystery, and you really want to keep going and finding out what's happening. And I wanted to update that and bring it into Istanbul. We all know the crazy stuff that's going on with Islam and people getting beheaded and people, you know, getting murdered and all sorts of wild plots and things. So I wanted to update it It starts off in Istanbul. It goes to Mosul, actually, which is a lot of trouble now, and ends up in London. And I spent quite a lot of time in London. So it ends up in London. There's a lot of things happening all across Europe about all this Islamic stuff happening across Europe. So hopefully it'll be interesting. We've had it. HarperCollins is the publisher. It was translated into 10 languages, and it's been in bookstores in the U.S. for a while now. It's also available on Amazon, of course. But that's the first one in this series, and then it moves on to the Jerusalem puzzle. I spent time in Jerusalem, an amazing city. A bit scary down some of the places I ended up in Jerusalem, but a really great understanding the history. Why is Jerusalem the way it is? Why have they got such a problem? Who's not, you know, who's not giving up there? And it was great understanding how people there have fought to make that city free, and what the pressures they've been put under. And it's not all, you know, right and wrong on either side, but about the human side of trying to defend Jerusalem for the Jewish state, which is there. So that's important. And that's the Jerusalem puzzle. It was reviewed in the Times of Israel. They gave it a very nice review. And then we went on to the Manhattan puzzle. Manhattan puzzle is, of course, about Manhattan and about bankers and about the secrets underneath Manhattan, buried in the rocks underneath Manhattan, some of the secret tunnels and things that are down there in Manhattan. So that's the third one. And the fourth one is out as well. That's the Nuremberg puzzle. And I'm currently writing and finishing the Cairo puzzle, which, of course, is set in Cairo. So all these are, this is a puzzle series of adventure mystery novels.
Well, you do such an incredible job of weaving in the history without making one feel like one is reading a history book. I one of the great writers who did this was Helen McGinnis. She wrote these wonderful mystery stories back in the 50s, early 60s. And I think it was always clear that she went to these places where she wrote about, and she knew these places, and she really made you feel like you were there. And you have done that just incredibly. I mean, of course, for me, I've been to most of these places. Well, actually, all of the places that you write about, and most of the places that other authors write about. And I'm always so disappointed when I get the feeling that they've just done their research on Wikipedia and Google Maps. So it's sure. Wonderful to have this authentic feel that you give your books.
Thanks. And I'm actually going to Cairo next week. I'm only going to spend a few days there, but I just want to make sure I get some of the things right. That's the Cairo puzzle, which is coming out in April. And that's about some of the interesting things that are emerging now about the Great Pyramid. You know, the Great Pyramid, that's the largest of those three pyramids just outside Cairo. And they've discovered so much interesting things, some new passageways and tunnels, which they're discovering there, and things about the alignment and how it's all set up there. It's really incredible, the Great Pyramid. So I'm going to be there inside the Great Pyramid in about 10 days' time.
Ooh.
To find some I'm writing about, and hopefully that'll be of interest, because I was always interested in Egypt and what's really going on with that pyramid. Why is it aligned magnetic to magnetic north? Why is it in the middle of the greatest landmass? What's the connection with Moses, for instance? You know, how is that connection, and what is the connection with various other things that have gone on, the physicians, the Fountain of Youth? Lots of things are connected with, you know, Egypt had a history of being some of the best physicians. If you were in Roman times, if you were the Roman emperor, you wanted an Egyptian physician, doctor, to look after you. So how did that all emerge? And how is it connected to a modern-day adventure? So this is the culmination of the puzzle series, brings us inside the Great Pyramid in Cairo.
Well, I really love your character, Sean Ryan. So well developed. And of course, there's the problem, there's Jack Ryan out there that everybody, you know,
sure.
thinks of. But Sean is more realistic. He's not a hero, but he gets into all these situations.
Sure. Well, I hope people see him as a hero.
No, I mean, he's
well.
A hero, but he's not like a superstar, or that he's, you know, he's been trained to, he's put into these situations. That's why I think when I read the Istanbul puzzle, I said to myself, well, this is exactly the type of thing that Alfred Hitchcock loves so much. He liked to take a man who's basically innocent, who didn't do anything wrong, and get him into a situation that then he has to get himself out of. And meanwhile, of course, learn so much and do so much. And that's exactly, Sean, I think, is a great character.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's the ordinary guy. Yes, he's got a job. He's an American. He's over in England. He's got a job working for an institute in Oxford. But he's thrown into this situation where he has to solve things. A friend of his is murdered, and he has to figure things out. And then there's people after him. So he has to figure things out. And that's what I relate to. I'm, an ordinary guy who has to figure things out, who has to fight back. So that's important.
Yeah, I agree. This is what I like. Jack Ryan, one never feels one could be in a Jack Ryan situation. Jack Ryan is, has all this training and stuff. But with Sean, you feel, this could happen to me. This could happen to, I could be on a trip and something like this could happen and what would I do? And Sean, has to figure it out. And that's what I think makes him so real. And why Nelson DeMille came to mind was the way you switch between first person and third person. I love that. I think it makes it the reader, it really pulls the reader into the story.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think it's great because sometimes if you get stuck in first person all the time, you can't move to what's happening in another city. So I like that idea. Yes, we're in Istanbul, but I'd like to also see what's going on in London or also see what's going on in another location. Find out, some of the other things that are impacting the story. So that's really why I used it.
Well, it's a wonderful writing device. Years ago, people would say you can't do it. You either do first person, you do third person. Brad Taylor's another person who alternates between them. And I think it brings an intimacy to the writing that you don't get when you're just third person.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I like being inside the head in first person to experience it, to feel the rain on your head, to feel what it's like to sweat when somebody's got a knife up against you, to feel that. That's what I like about first person, is that you can really feel you're inside the story.
Oh.
And with third,
when Sean gets into some of these situations, oh, wow, they're really heart-stopping. And your writing is very crisp. I love your writing. I would say, you have short sentences, often with short sentences, which really move. It's almost like a beat of a drum. Boom, ba-da, boom, ba-da, boom. You're reading your sentences, and I'm saying, whoa, I'm going here, I'm going here. I'm moving. And this book is... I can't put it down because I have to keep reading.
Oh, thanks. Well, when things happen to you, when you get stuck in a tunnel underground and it starts filling up with water and then the eels start coming through, you just want to move and get out of there, right? So that's, and I've been in situations you have to move, you have to get things done, And it's great. I love that style, and that's what I want to. I want to give readers something exciting, something that's contemporary, that mixes in some of the things we're all concerned about and mixes that in with an adventure and a character who's going to come out and solve this puzzle.
Exactly. A very clever to come out with this whole puzzle series because each one is a puzzle, and I think people should just start right from the beginning because the Istanbul puzzle, although it was written in it came out first several years ago.
2012, yeah.
Yeah. So,
5 years ago.
But it's relevant today. So it's just wonderful.
Wonderful.
One of the things I want to say is, I want to tell everybody about is, we're in our third year now of the Dublin Writers Conference. And you, of course, are invited, Patsy, as you know. That's in June. That's the last weekend in June here in Dublin. And it is the only writers' conference here in Dublin. And we have Dr. Ken Achdy, who's a Hollywood producer, produced over 30 movies. And you might have heard of Heather Graham. the multi-New York Times bestselling author. She's coming here. So that's the Dublin Writers Conference. Anyone wants to we have a lot of U.S. Authors coming here. It's just for writers. It's a networking event, but also writing craft and digital marketing. So those are the things, and I hope you don't mind me mentioning that.
No, not at all. It's a wonderful... Oh, to come to Dublin is a fantastic trip for anybody. And if they're interested in a trip to Europe, I can't recommend anything more highly than going to Dublin. It's a perfect location. Lovely country to visit. And wow, you can walk on James Joyce's streets and really, you know, take it all in.
Well, the pub right beside us is where James Joyce used to drink. And half of my cousins are in the States, from Los Angeles through Alabama all the way up to New York and Washington. I have cousins all over. So anyone from the States who comes here is welcomed as a long-lost cousin. And we always have a great time and look after people. The conference is in the Gresham Hotel, which is the top hotel on our main street, O'Connell Street. So it's in the Gresham Hotel last weekend in June, and we have readings on the Friday night. We have an award dinner on the Saturday night, and Heather and Ken will be speaking. Ken is from Los Angeles, such a nice guy, a Fulbright professor previously, and produced over 30 movies, but a genuinely nice guy. And so that's what we like. People can mix. It's a smaller conference. There's like 100, 150 people, depending on how many we get this year, somewhere between those numbers. But so it's a smaller conference, but focused on networking and making sure people can have time with the instructors that they listen to, and people can network with the other writers here. And so that's the important thing for us, networking. And for writers, a community is so important. You know this, Patsy, a community that we talk to each other, and that we support each other, and that we give back to each other. So that's important for me, that writers can come here to Dublin, experience the city of Joyce and Oscar Wilde, and meet other writers here.
Oh, well, I am so glad that you mentioned this. I was not aware of it, and I just want to tell all of my listeners out there that if any of you want to sign up for this wonderful event, Joy on Paper will give you $100 towards your trip and towards this.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing, Patsy. Thank you.
Okay.
That's really
okay.
Good. That's amazing. You're so generous, Patsy. That is really good. And you know it's tax deductible. For most authors who are making an income from their writing, it's tax deductible. So that's really good. That's really amazing. And your place at the conference is free, of course, Patsy. And you're also invited to speak here as well. I know there's, you know, you got the travel and all that, but that's what we'd like to do. And we support as many writers as possible getting here. And you're really good to contribute that to the other writers who want to come here. We'll support as many writers as possible coming here from the States and meeting the other writers, these Irish writers. There's a lot of Irish writers going to be here. It's usually about 50-50. We get writers coming in. We have a lady coming in from Ecuador, somebody coming in from France. We had a very nice writer coming in from India last year. So we have a mix of different people. It's really fun.
Well, I will also put up a link on my webpage for all the writers out there. I'll put a link to the website, your website, for this conference so that they can, sign up. And I will put up also the notice there that I will give $100 to anyone who signs up. And I just want to encourage, as you said, it's so important for writers to belong to a community and to take part in events. And I can't think of any place lovelier than Dublin to do a writers' conference.
That's great. I really appreciate that. We've got one of the other things that we do training courses as well. On top of our conference, we do other training courses. I think it's really important that writers learn about marketing. So we've got the writing craft session and craft sessions, and Ken and Heather and other writing craft instructors here who've been teaching writing craft for many, many years. We've got those. But it's also important to get the digital marketing side right. We have this big opportunity now, which is the internet. As you know, years ago, we couldn't reach readers. We had to walk up and down outside on the street with a, you know, something over our, you know, over our bodies about talking about our book. You know, we had to find other ways. But now we've got the internet. Digital marketing is important, and it can be done in a way that fits in with each author's style, which fits in with the way, with the amount of time you have. So we're doing marketing on Twitter, on Facebook, on email, and all those things. So there's real opportunities for people to learn about how to increase your monthly income. This is what the writers we've worked with, the writers who come here who take part in our training, they want to increase their monthly income. And some of them are making more money as an independent author than they used to make under the traditional publishing system. Also, you know, Amazon pays every month. So if you can build your reader base. Now, the things you're talking about, they have to be popular books. They have to be books that people are likely to buy. But you can, once you have that in place and once you have the quality of your writing, we can't lose that. The quality of the writing has to be important. But you can find readers. And people know now, the latest reports are that about 25% of Amazon's top 100 are from indie authors. And the market is likely to expand in the next few years between now and 2020 to a $30 billion ebook market. So $30 billion in the U.S., that's a huge opportunity for authors. But we have to focus on the quality of writing. They have to be popular genres, things that people want to read. And then we all have to learn about marketing, and we're doing some of the new things that are coming out. There's lots of new email marketing and video and radio shows and lots of new ways and conferences that we can communicate with each other, that we can support each other. There's teams, authors getting together in teams. So if people are willing to explore this and be positive about what can come out of it, then we see authors who are making money, and I can point to, I know authors who are making good money every month from the indie route. It's not everybody can do this. And as I say, your book has to be in a popular genre. But if you have that and it's well written and you do the marketing, then there's a real possibility of making money. And you know this too. I'm sure you know many indie authors who are making good money, Patsy.
Absolutely. Well, it has been just wonderful to talk to you today. You are an inspiration. As I said, I will put a link up on my website. And what is your website for people to?
Okay, you can find the Dublin Writers Conference at smarturl.it/Dublin Conference. smarturl.it/Dublin Conference.
Okay.
Or you can just go to Google and put in the Dublin Writers Conference. There is only one. Okay. So you will find that, and you'll find links there through to our main site and our training and the other courses we do, promotion work we also do, and through that into the books, my books, and all of that. Just look it up, the Istanbul Puzzle on Amazon. That's where, if you are interested in the puzzle series, then the Istanbul Puzzle is available on Amazon and all good bookstores, as they say.
And it is a wonderful book. And everybody who starts with the Istanbul Puzzle will become instant puzzle maniacs. And they will not stop, because your books are absolutely fantastic. And I am so, so happy that you were able to join us today and give us so much great information and inspiration, which is what writers need. So I am really just so grateful. So everyone go out there and get Lawrence O'Brien's book, all of his puzzle books, but start with the Istanbul Puzzle, and you will have a fantastic weekend. And meanwhile, I just want to thank you again for being on, and I hope that, once the Cairo one comes out, I hope you'll come back on.
I'd love to, Patsy, and thank you very much for featuring me. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, it's been a joy for me, and I will have you. I will feature this interview up on my archive page on Sunday, so that everyone can listen to it again and be inspired.
Thanks, Patsy. That's
okay.
Great. And bye to everyone, and take it easy.
Okay, and keep writing. Okay, Have a wonderful time in Cairo. Be safe and just have a wonderful time. Okay? Are you going to put pictures up on your website?
I will, yeah. I'm hoping to do a 360 virtual reality tour inside the pyramid as well. That'll be fun.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Absolutely. Well, you have a wonderful trip, and we look forward to talking to you when the Cairo puzzle comes out, okay?
Thanks. That's great, Patsy. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. He is an inspiration. He is fantastic. You know, I have not, you know, I read a lot of books, and I don't know where I missed this book. First of all, as you heard, he's absolutely delightful, and I love the Irish accent. And when I got this Istanbul puzzle, I sat down and I started reading it. I was in awe because I had not been so overwhelmed by the first few pages of a book for a long time, because, well, at least for 3 weeks. You know, I get so many books and I get so many great authors, but wow, I'm sitting and I'm saying, whoa, this guy can't be this good. And he is. And he has really developed a wonderful, wonderful series. So I know that everybody will enjoy this. And don't read the blurb on Amazon about it. Just get it. Don't read that little blurb. I hate when they ruin the beginning of a book and tell you what happens. You know, you want to read it for yourself, because I didn't know. I didn't know in the first two pages what was going to happen to, you know, how the start was. And I didn't want, I'm so happy that I didn't read the Amazon blurb first, because I think it's awful. And I just like when, when the story comes out and you're sort of flowing along with it. And you don't know what's going to happen. Believe me, there's so many things happening in his books that one every few pages is something new and something exciting. So anyway, I just want to thank everyone for being here today. I have a great weekend. Bill Larson, as I said, he is just a fantastic. He's our legal eagle. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to call him. He's fantastic. He just opened today. I think today was his grand opening of his Tampa office. So if you're on that side of the bridge over there, you can go in and see him there or here over in the St. Petersburg side. And he will. The nice thing, make sure, please, that all of your, you know, when you're thinking about leaving your copyrights onto your family, you want to make sure that they are all done correctly. So make sure, if you haven't done everything right, that you contact him and just get it all done properly, because you never know. You never know when a series, like I think when Lawrence O'Brien started, and I'm sure these books are going to be picked up for film. And next Tuesday, I'm going to talk about some of the scripts that were nominated for Oscars based on books, and I'm trying to get the authors in to talk about their books. But meanwhile, remember that one of the joys in life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So take time this weekend to read and to write and to listen to an Audible version. If you're interested in a really great Audible version of A Gentleman in Moscow, Nick Guy Smith did this Audible. It's incredible. So you will really enjoy it. And meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. And this is Patsy with a Z, hoping that you will say something nice to somebody today. And I will say something nice to Chris, who is taking over for Ed today. And he's in the control room. And thank you, Chris. Thanks for everything. Good job. Okay, bye now. Have a great weekend.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City Tampa Bay WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
It's time for the Thursday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. Prior to speaking from Toronto, I mentioned yesterday that a nasty storm was moving through New Brunswick. It was bringing wet snow and freezing rain. Well, it certainly messed things up. Among other things, more than 130,000 customers of New Brunswick Power were without hydro service all day. Some were still being reconnected, and most school districts were closed. The Moncton region seemed to be hardest hit. 2 days ago, southern Ontario and southern Quebec got a nasty mix of wet snow, ice pellets, and freezing rain. Well, a lot of that's being washed away today, as rain has moved in, to be followed by a dusting of snow tomorrow. In the news, the sponsorship scandal that brought down the federal Liberal government in Ottawa back in 2006 is back in the news again. An ex-Liberal Party organizer in Quebec, Jacques Corriveau, who was convicted last fall of fraud, has been sentenced to a 4-year prison term. He's been given a 10-year period to pay a fine of $1.4 million. After the sentence was read out, the 83-year-old Corriveau was handcuffed and led away. An appeal is pending. In Edmonton, Travis Vader has been sentenced to life in prison after being convicted on 2 counts of manslaughter in the deaths of 2 missing seniors, Lyle and Marie McCann. They haven't been seen alive for the past 6.5 years. They were beginning a road trip in their RV when they disappeared after gassing up at a gas station in St. Albert. Their burned-out RV was found 2 days later near Edson. Asked if he had anything to say to the court, Vader said, and I quote, "This court has convicted an innocent man. I'll continue to fight to clear my name." He's eligible for parole in 7 years.